This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, the 4th of August, 2008. From Pacifica Station KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Barack Obama changes his position and says he would support more offshore drilling.
What I've said is I'm willing to consider it if it's necessary to actually pass a comprehensive plan.
A group of U.S. activists set sail from Cyprus in an attempt to deliver medical supplies to Palestinians and challenge Israeli control of Gaza.
Why would they stop us? Why don't they stand up by what they say, that Gaza is free and the Palestinians are free in Gaza?
And we begin coverage of the 2008 International HIV/AIDS Conference, where activists took over a symposium sponsored by Bristol Myers Squibb. All that and more after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The United Nations nuclear watchdog says that a slight amount of plutonium leaked from its aging laboratory outside Vienna. The International Atomic Energy Agency claims that no radioactive contamination reached the environment and reports no injuries. An investigation is ongoing, but an IAEA spokesperson says technical deficiencies at the outdated lab were not the cause. Iran said this morning that it has test-fired a weapon capable of reaching the Strait of Hormuz and warned that it could close off tanker traffic there if attacked. 40% of the world's oil passes through the waterway. And the United Nations Security Council met today via teleconference to discuss Iran. Heder Rizvi reports from the UN.
Ambassador Jan Graus of Belgium, who took charge of the UN Security Council this month, said today Iran was not on the Council's agenda. But according to U.S. officials, five permanent members of the Council and Germany met by telephone today to discuss Iran after the Islamic State missed a Saturday deadline to respond to Council's incentives. U.S. officials say the six have no option but to pursue other measures against Iran. During talks in Geneva last month, the United States and other international powers had given Iran about 15 days to respond to their package of incentives to roll back its nuclear program. The United States and its Western allies suspect that Iran is trying to develop nuclear weapons, but Tehran says its nuclear program is meant to develop electricity and that it is doing so in accordance with the International Treaty on Nuclear Non-Proliferation. Iran has often accused the U.S. and other Western powers of taking a hypocritical stance on nuclear issue because they never questioned the possession of hundreds of nuclear weapons by Israel. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
Anti-war demonstrations continued today at the Port of Olympia in Washington State despite arrests over the weekend. Protesters opposed the use of the port by the Army's 4th Stryker Brigade returning from Iraq. Mark Taylor Canfield has more from Seattle.
So far, 5 days of protests have been organized by the Port Militarization Resistance, a coalition of anti-war groups who are opposed to the use of the Port of Olympia by U.S. Army units fighting in Iraq. The demonstrations began last week when a U.S. military ship, the USNS Britain, began unloading 900 military vehicles returning from the war in Iraq. Clashes between police and demonstrators during recent protests in Olympia and Tacoma have resulted in 11 arrests. 6 people were arrested last week after they dropped an anti-war banner from an overpass on Interstate 5 near Fort Lewis. 2 were arrested at the port when they crossed a police barrier. Yesterday, 3 more demonstrators were arrested at the Port of Olympia when they briefly blockaded the road at the gate of the port facilities. The activists were booked into the Pierce County Jail on suspicion of disorderly conduct. During the incident, a man was tasered by police and required medical treatment at Tacoma General Hospital. Last year, dozens of protesters were arrested at the port during anti-war demonstrations, including an Olympia City Council member. This is Mark Taylor Canfield for Free Speech Radio News in Seattle.
After the Association for Civil Rights in Israel appealed to the Supreme Court there, the Israeli government reversed itself today and returned 87 Fatah members to the West Bank city of Jericho. Free Speech Radio News' Rami Al-Magari has more from Gaza.
Israel originally said the men would be returned to Gaza, but today the government reversed that decision and announced the Fatah members would be sent to the West Bank, saying their lives would be in danger should they be sent to Hamas-controlled Gaza. Yesterday, 32 were sent to Gaza and were detained by Hamas police, who then released all but 5. On Saturday, The Hamas-led police forces exchanged heavy gunfire with Fatah loyalists in eastern Gaza City after the Hamas government demanded the extradition of several suspects from a large Gaza clan known as the Hellas. The weekend clashes claimed the lives of 11 Palestinians, including two Hamas policemen, and wounded scores of others. More than 180 Fatah men, including a wounded Fatah strongman, Ahmed Hillis, fled to nearby Israeli territories. The Hamas Interior Ministry says the operation against the Hillisi clan was necessary to ensure the arrest of suspects who were allegedly involved in a deadly car blast on July 25. Since Hamas has taken over Gaza in June 2007, the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah has been taking care of approximately 250 Gazan Fatah men and seniors who left Gaza following Hamas's seizure of the coastal territory. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
The man who may well become South Africa's next president was in court today trying to get corruption charges against him dropped while thousands of supporters rallied outside. Jacob Zuma denies charges of corruption, fraud, money laundering, and racketeering, but says he will step down if convicted. The pending matter is the largest roadblock to Zuma's succeeding current president, Thabo Mbeki. A protracted trial could overlap a general election in 2009, a near certain win for Zuma, who stands accused of taking over $500,000 over a decade. He is also accused of seeking a bribe from a French group in a massive arms deal arranged by South Africa in the late 1990s. From WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
AIDS activists, organized by ACT UP Paris, made their voices heard at a symposium sponsored by pharmaceutical giant Bristol Myers Squibb yesterday, coinciding with the launch of the 17th annual AIDS conference being held in Mexico City this week. Bristol Myers Squibb announced in March that it would stop distribution of a vital HIV drug for children known as efavirenz, a move that activists denounced as they took the stage and microphone at the symposium. Worldwide, more than 300,000 children died from AIDS last year alone. An estimated 420,000 children contracted the virus. Bristol Myers Squibb, along with pharmaceutical giants like Merck and Pfizer, are sponsoring and attending the AIDS conference, where more than 20,000 doctors, scientists, policymakers, and activists are coming together in Mexico City this week to strategize on how to tackle the looming pandemic. 27 years after the first case was confirmed in the United States, more than 30 million people are living with HIV today. Matt Curtis is one of several activists and bloggers posting their audio interviews, photos, and videos of the conference at AIDS2008.com. He spoke with Konstantin Lehentsev, director of the All Ukraine Network of People Living with HIV. Lehentsev says one of the issues is people with dual and triple diagnoses, those who have HIV, TB, and are intravenous drug users.
Basically, our mission is to break this problem and to really see how the ARV scale-up will be influenced on the decrease of the mortality rates, which should be the key objective of the ARV treatment. And for this, we definitely need to face the problem of marginalized groups, and particularly IDUs. We're still in a concentrated epidemic with more than 40% of all cases among injecting drug users. The mortality rates are especially among the people who have been diagnosed with HIV/AIDS 1999-2001 and only now are looking for services or not looking for those.
Although they are treating more people with HIV in the Ukraine now than several years ago, Lehentsev says limited resources and regulatory barriers are still an obstacle.
We do not have actually still regulatory basis that will permit the effective scale-up and integration of substitution treatment and effective drug treatment services into the system of organizing care for HIV-positive people. Out of 27 AIDS centers who are providing ARV care, only two has actually a license for narcotic medicines that they can start. Out of 35 TB centers, where majority of people living with HIV are actually finding sometimes their final place, to my biggest regret, and there are only couple, only couple, now it's a bit more, like five, got the license and starting substitution treatment under the project of International AIDS Alliance and the network.
And that was Constantine Lehensa, one of thousands of people that have made their way to Mexico City for the International AIDS Conference. Blogging has become a way to communicate for those who couldn't make it to the conference. Health professional students from the U.S., Kenya, and Uganda have uploaded video postcards at AIDS2008.com, adding their voices to the conversations about HIV/AIDS advocacy.
Hi, this is Ambrose Agweyu. I'm a fifth-year medical student at the University of Nairobi. If you out there could support us with increased funding to increase our capacity in terms of our numbers in the health workforce, we would be heading in the right direction. I hope we can work together and solve the problem HIV/AIDS has become. Thank you.
I am Fatma Fadl Jahadmi, third year medical student at the University of Nairobi, doing a Bachelor of Medicine and Bachelor of Surgery. I'm addressing the primary health care, as in for Kenya here, how do you know where you're going if you do not know the destination? As in, so we do not expect people to get their rights if they do not know what their rights entail. So the basic things that we're supposed to be doing is teaching the patients their own rights, as the same time educating the health providers of how they should be dealing with patients. And moreover, the staff, we are understaffed, so we should also be staffing people so that they can reciprocate humanly.
My name is Sabina Kyle. I'm in Los Angeles, California, and I'm a student at USC.
I'm Jolene Sawyer, and I'm a medical student at the USC Keck School of Medicine. World AIDS is a huge problem. Right now, 72% of the healthcare burden is in Africa, but they only have 3% of all the world's healthcare professionals.
In fact, there are more Ethiopian physicians serving in Chicago than there are in Ethiopia itself. The U.S. has been a global leader in the fight against AIDS, but we cannot sustain our progress unless we begin to fight for the fundamental right to health. Governments have to build healthcare systems that are available, accessible, affordable, and of good quality.
To make this a reality, the U.S. must provide bold leadership.
And those are just some of the voices of professional health students being highlighted at AIDS2008.org. Presumed Democratic nominee Barack Obama laid out a new energy plan full of short-term and long-term goals. His long-term goal? Complete U.S. energy independence within 10 years. In the meantime, Obama says he's open to expanding offshore oil drilling, which marks a shift in his position. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports.
Speaking in Michigan, home to the U.S. carbon-based car industry, Obama said his new energy policy would depend on domestic resources, a combination of renewable, coal, oil, and nuclear energy, to the tune of $150 billion in 10 years.
In 10 years, we will eliminate the need for oil from the entire Middle East and Venezuela. In 10 years' time.
To do so, he would deploy a combination of incentives and tax credits to business and consumers. The goal, 1 million hybrid cars that go 150 miles per gallon, double the amount of energy from renewable energy, and promote energy conservation, all within 6 years. Obama says his plan would put the U.S. on a path to reduce carbon emissions by 80% in 50 years. In addition to laying out that plan, Obama signaled he'd support more offshore drilling. A compromise proposal offered last week by five Republicans and five Democratic senators to overcome a stalemate in Washington.
Like all compromises, this one has its drawbacks. It does include a limited amount of new offshore drilling. And while I still don't believe that's a particularly meaningful short-term or long-term solution, what I've said is I'm willing to consider it if it's necessary to actually pass a comprehensive plan.
The Gang of Ten compromise would greatly expand alternative energy. It would also provide nuclear subsidies and expand offshore drilling. Environmental groups are disappointed with Obama's compromise strategy. Nick Burning is with Friends of the Earth Action.
He's offering some really bold things that we haven't been seeing from Washington before, and some really important things. And, we would just urge him to stay focused on those proposals and not get distracted by this stuff going on in the Senate right now. The Gang of Ten plan isn't a real solution, and we hope that Senator Obama doesn't treat it as such.
Obama's new support of offshore drilling seems to put him at odds with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Pelosi said Friday expanded offshore drilling is non-negotiable.
OCS is used as a political ploy I will not be a participant in that scheme. But don't try to insult the intelligence of the American people by saying, but for drilling in those protected areas, gasoline would be cheaper. It's simply not true.
Republicans, though, say offshore drilling is necessary now. Republican Mike Pence of Indiana is one of several lawmakers at a deserted U.S. Capitol Monday.
And what you are about to witness is the beginning of a sustained effort to demand that Speaker Pelosi bring this Congress back to Washington, D.C., and give us an up or down vote on an energy bill that includes more access to American oil. We are committed to that, and I'm honored to stand with these men and women to do just that.
Republican John McCain has picked up on this tactic and is calling on Barack Obama to bring Congress back in session to vote on oil drilling, even though Obama has no power as a senator or as a presidential candidate to initiate such action. Meanwhile, Obama is connecting McCain to the pockets of big oil. McCain has also recently come out in support of more offshore drilling. He's also supportive of more nuclear, more coal, and more alternative energy. Obama released this TV ad today.
Now Big Oil's filling John McCain's campaign with $2 million in contributions.
That $2 million number could be slightly inflated, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. But McCain has definitely received nearly $1.5 million from oil and gas during this election. Also, according to the Center for Responsive Politics, Obama has also received money from the oil and gas industry. Less than McCain, but still nearly $500,000. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. FSRN has brought you uncensored news from the U.S. and around the world every day for more than 7 years. We're proud of our history of challenging old models of media access and control by highlighting the voices of marginalized communities most affected by social and economic policy changes. Now, a large funding cut and economic hard times jeopardize our ability to continue producing a daily newscast. You can visit us online at fsrn.org to find out more about how you can help keep us on the air. That's fsrn.org. A diverse group calling itself the Free Gaza Movement is heading to Gaza from Cyprus to challenge Israeli control of the territory. They say that in 2005, when Israel removed its settlements, it didn't surrender control of Gaza's borders, making the land what they call an open-air prison with no way in and no way out. So they're trying a new approach to get through by sea. FSRN's Tanya Snyder has more.
The Free Gaza Movement is made up of 40 people from 16 countries who want to break what they see as Israel's stranglehold on Gaza. They say Israel still controls Gaza's air, land, and sea despite their withdrawal from the territory in 2005. ReliefWeb, the United Nations website providing information on humanitarian relief, reports that Israeli forces have kept border crossings closed for the last year and a half, blocking the flow of food, medicine, consumer goods, and people, with disastrous humanitarian impacts. Paul Arudi is one of the Free Gaza Movement organizers. He says the borders with Israel and even Egypt are tightly controlled.
But that's not the case for the part of Gaza that's on the coast and faces the Mediterranean. And that is next to international waters. So we thought if we sail in through international waters directly into Gaza, which is apparently something that has not been done since 1967, then we can avoid those pitfalls, and Israel really shouldn't have any objection to that.
The group plans to leave from Cyprus and set sail for Gaza on Tuesday. Many of the group's members have traveled to Gaza and the West Bank before, and many have engaged in nonviolent protest around the issue. That's one reason they don't know what to expect when they show up on Gaza's shores. They say Israel has a history of turning back Palestinian sympathizers. Bill Dienst is the ship's medical officer. He's been traveling to Gaza since 1985.
The more human rights work you do, the more you can be blacklisted.
The group is bringing some medical supplies, but its purpose is not simply to make donations. They want to challenge Israel's claim that they do not occupy Gaza. Monir Deeb is a Gazan who now lives in the United States. He says Israelis force Egyptians to enforce their blockade on their shared border with Gaza as well, threatening the Egyptians with loss of U.S. aid money if they refuse. Still, he says Israel has no reason to stop their boat.
Why would they stop us? Why don't they stand up by what they say, that Gaza is free and the Palestinians are free in Gaza?
Deeb says he signed up for the trip after he heard a story on Pacifica Radio about it. And then he found out about Hedy Epstein, an 83-year-old Holocaust survivor who lost both parents in Auschwitz. She was told that she couldn't go on the trip to Gaza because she doesn't know how to swim.
And she said, no, I will go. And she hired a swimming instructor to learn to swim so she can go. So I looked at myself, I said, shame on you. I am a capable person. I am going to be on that boat.
Epstein says even at the height of panic at the beginning of the war in Germany, her parents refused to go to Palestine.
There was one place they were not willing to go to, and that was Palestine, because they were ardent anti-Zionists. And I didn't, as a child, completely understand what that meant. But if my parents were anti-Zionists, then I was an anti-Zionist also.
The group has not asked for Israel's permission to visit Gaza. LaRudy says that a news reporter told a senior security official about the trip and asked how they would react, and the Israeli official said it's fine with him if the group wants to spend their vacation in Hamasdan. Free Gaza Movement is hoping that that will be the Israeli reaction, but as Mary Hughes says, they're ready for anything.
Either way, I think for us it's a win-win situation. I mean, it's not a win-win situation if they blow us out of the water or try to blow us up or something, but we don't really think they're going to do that, but there isn't a one of us who doesn't recognize that possibility.
As the medical officer, Bill Dientz says he's preparing for a mass casualty situation, but the group members think the most likely scenario is that they'll simply be stopped. If they are stopped, they plan to carry out a sit-down strike at sea. But if they're allowed in, they'll establish a ferry service between Palestine and Cyprus, helping Palestinians use the freedom of movement they've found so difficult to enjoy. For FSRN, I'm Tanya Snyder.
Access to clean water is a major source of tension in key regions throughout the world. Quetta is the largest city in Pakistan's Balochistan province, which borders Afghanistan. Quetta was once called Little London, famed for its cleanliness and efficient city planning, and known as Pakistan's fruit basket. But as FSRN's Mudassar Shah reports, this sensitive international border city has changed and is facing a new conflict over water.
In Quetta, farmers like Sadat Chagzai are cutting down trees. Once they used to water and look after with care. The reason, a severe water shortage.
I have been working in this orchard for the last 32 years. My ancestors worked in this orchard, but now I have to leave this beautiful orchard. I looked after the fruit trees like they were my children. I spent all my time here.
Many other farmers around Quetta have already cut down their orchards due to the shortage of water and increasing property prices. There are three main reasons of water crisis in the region: population growth, overexploitation of groundwater, and drought. Faiz Kakkad, a community trainer with the United Nations Development Program, says people have no options but to move.
It is very clear that in some areas, the whole village is migrated from the area because there is no water even for the drinking purpose. It is crystal clear that the people have to migrate from the area.
Quetta was originally built for some 50,000 people, but now it is a home for more than 20 million. The region lies outside the monsoon zone and depends on the underground water reserves. Again, Kakkad.
People and the community member are violating this in the use of this natural resource. There is no check and balance. The upper middle class persons who have a lot of wells and they are discharging the water for 24 hours. And even then, if they don't need the water, they are selling out the underground water. It is very dangerous, especially for the depletion of the water table in our province.
A decade ago, water was available about 100 feet below the surface. Now, they have to dig more than 300 feet into the ground. Tube wells diverted water away from the centuries-old underground channels used to irrigate the fruit trees in the orchards. Local resident Sayed Ahmad Elisha is angry that water is not being shared fairly.
What we do understand is that if there's no water in my home and it's coming from a tube well nearby, yeah, you can call it water mafia.
The unplanned use of groundwater resources led to steady over-exploitation. People who can afford to have private tube well build them indiscriminately. Sayed Ahmad Elisha, a disaster management professional, says the water system is flawed.
Water is also escaped into the distribution system because of the leakages, seepages, and illegal connections. We don't have water, potable water, to drink. And we are giving NOCs for digging 2,000, 3,000 additional wells, tube wells.
The government announced a series of projects to address the water crisis. They are promising to fix leakages and create new water supply schemes. However, the government announced a series of projects to address the water crisis. They are promising to fix leakages and create new water supply schemes. However, Shirzada, the manager of the local water department, is pessimistic.
I accept there are many flaws in our system and the government needs to step up. I know the people have many problems, especially drinking water. The government has initiated some projects to solve this issue, but I'm not sure it will bring any positive change.
And while locals wait for action, medical workers are warning them to not drink the local water. Dr. Shams Kakar from the Bolan Medical College warns the locals about waterborne disease and tells everyone to drink boiled water. Hundreds of families who used to summer in Quetta are deciding not to make Quetta their second hometown. Because of the water shortage, many are selling their homes. Shahin Shah and his family have spent their summer holidays in Quetta for the last 10 years. Now, they are looking for somewhere else.
This year, we spent a month here and found that I and my family had many diseases. The doctor says it is due to water, and now I feel that too. I'm leaving Quetta now and not coming back unless the water issue is solved.
Water has just opened another frontier of problems to Pakistan. In this conflict-stricken province of Balochistan. And some experts predict Quetta could become a barren city in the near future. From Quetta in Pakistan, I'm Mudassar Shah for Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Thanks today to the many bloggers at AIDS2008.com. From Pacifica Station, KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.